cold night, clear sky. You were a kid when you looked up at all those stars, after someone told you there were worlds out there, and you wondered if they looked like ours, if someone who looked like you was standing on one of them, if they were looking back at you. But to the best of our knowledge, the human being is the only species in the universe capable of asking these questions. And I've often wondered, does that leave us with some kind of responsibility?
How do we transcend these limits with our minds and our machines?
This season, we built a world. We took a dead desert planet and we brought it to life. We populated that world. We talked about the shape its society might take. We talked about the shape that society should take. And now I want you to imagine someone else staring up into that clear sky on that cold night, looking up into all of those stars. Maybe it's your granddaughter, your great-great-grandson, on Mars. Their world, their home, was our first step as a species towards becoming a spacefaring civilization. But where do we go from there? In the words of Mike Collins, the moon is not a destination, it's a direction. And Mars is just humanity's next step on that same journey. Beyond the red planet, now blue and green, lush forests and big, puffy white clouds, we're on our way to different stars, to whole different solar systems. This is our season 2 finale, and we're looking at interstellar travel. First, how do we do it? And then the broader question, why do we have to? What is our purpose? I don't mean in this podcast, I mean as a species. It might sound a little cheesy to talk about the meaning of life, but that does not make the question any less essential. And what I've been thinking is the answer, or at least an answer I would like to submit here for consideration, is that the purpose of humanity might just be saving the universe from extinction. From Founders Fund, I'm Mike Solana, and this is Anatomy of Next. New World.
Life is important because it's a fundamentally weird thing to happen. We might be it.
No end and no heat death, simply a heat evolution.
You can think about getting to Alpha Centauri in a human lifetime.
We're embarking on a cosmic journey through space from our home on planet Earth to Mars and then beyond. But today, before we get into the mechanics of what a human journey to new stars, to new solar systems is going to look like, it's worth addressing something that's come up in a handful of my interviews this season. The human being is not especially durable. Food, water, temperature, radiation, social engagement, meaning, love. A friend of mine once said, if we were a machine, he would throw us out. We require a lot to stay alive. And so it's really a lot of work keeping us alive in space. Quick interlude. What if we didn't go to space ourselves at all? If the preservation of life is our goal, what if we just sent a kind of cosmic seed packet into the universe?
I'm Richard Fuse. I'm a bioengineering graduate from Stanford. I just started working on a secret project out of a home lab in my apartment.
Richard isn't really an expert on mailing distant stars cosmic DNA printers, because you might be surprised to discover there's not really any such thing as an expert in that particular space. Like so many of the concepts we've looked at this season, the technology or the science to implement the concept is there, or roughly there. But there's not really a working plan to execute the vision. This is, I believe, true in the context of our Mars mission and extremely true in the context of seeding the universe with life. Richard's just a bio grad who was inspired by the thought himself. That inspiration brought him to science and technology and to his current important, but unfortunately, quite stealthy work. I just thought that was cool. So let's take a look at this motivating vision, which, if ever realized, would change what it means to be human. I met Richard on Twitter. We were both at the same biohacking conference, but on different days. I talked about it online. He at-replied me. And we got to talking about, well, two things. One, this super stealth project that he's working on, but two, the kind of interesting thinking from which this idea for his company emerged, and that was a different cut on terraforming. So this season on Anatomy of Next, we've talked a lot about terraforming in a kind of traditional approach, using lots of robots and people to change the chemical composition of a planet, build an atmosphere, build oceans, and then seed that planet with life. But what if we did it remotely?
Yeah, so I'm sort of talking about how can biology solve fundamental human problems, right? And terraforming is one of those problems, because as an engineer, you want to avoid single point failures. You want to be able to say that no individual component of Earth is, if that fails, we're done. And so we started talking about how could you get other planets ready for human habitation. And it doesn't have to happen overnight. I mean, we don't have to be on Mars next week. Earth will be okay for some time. But
like, and, I mean, we hope.
Yeah, we hope. Yeah. But we don't know exactly how long that's going to be.
I mean, this is like the black swan. We can't see it coming. It could be massive. It should be massive. Every sort of major cataclysmic event has been the worst one until the next one. Maybe we're going to need a new planet someday. I don't know. We have this current approach to terraforming, super labor intensive, human intensive. Also, we're kind of limited by space. We can only terraform things that are reasonably close to us. What's another way we might go about this?
So the slow part of terraforming is the getting there in most cases, because if you're talking about going to Mars, that's, you know, maybe a couple of years or less, depending on how quickly you want to go. But the moment you start talking about leaving our solar system, going to, say, Alpha Centauri or any other planets, we got to start thinking about, with the current technology, how slow a process that's going to be. And for the size of sending a human carrier out there or sending people to sleep, that like famous sci-fi idea of like a whole bunch of pods all land on a planet and then have to build it, that may happen at some point, but it would be nice if you could send life there first to sort of establish an outpost. Earth began 2.7 billion years ago with algae that took what was a completely inhospitable environment, produced the world's first oxygen in the atmosphere, right? And basically set the groundwork for the rest of life to move in. And the question would just be, can you send microorganisms like that to these other planets? And if we're not in a crazy hurry, let those organisms basically grow, evolve, and then transform the soil and the atmosphere and the planet into something that is more habitable.
There are a lot of interesting things about this to me, but one that is standing out is the time horizons. I think most of the projects that we're working on right now in the world are shorter than a human lifespan. People are doing things and building things so they can reap the benefits from them themselves. This is like this, it's a different way of interacting with the world, period. It's like, as people, we do this thing that preserves life. We make small steps towards this, and we might not see the benefits of this. It's just what we are and what we have to do. Just the idea of there being life elsewhere is comforting to us in some way that has to be wired into us.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's an egotistical thing, or maybe it just takes the pressure off. I mean, I think that's really what's so great about it, because you say, you know, obviously we want to get Earth right, but there's no guarantees that we will. So you just, you're hedging your bets a little bit.
What would this look like? Paint a picture for me of sending what... life printers to different alien worlds.
The idea is relatively straightforward from a high-level standpoint. You need a couple components to make it work. You need a way to make DNA, specifically sort of gene-length DNA, so 1,000 bases.
And we can't do this right now.
Yeah, it's very difficult to do it right now in a small, compact way. And then you need to take some cells. You need to be able to freeze them down and have them sit in cold storage for 100 years. We think you can do this now with like minus 80 freezers. People have been able to successfully pull out cell stocks from decades and decades ago, but we don't know for sure how well that will work. And then you need a way to get the DNA into those cells to genetically engineer them. And there's a lot of researchers who are automating that process right now. A company like Ginkgo Bioworks, that's pretty much standard par for the course to have an automated system that can put those genes in. And then kind of the special sauce, the fundamental question that you need to answer is, how do you know what genes you need to put in the organism to make it work? And that's the problem that's going to be the hardest to solve. That's why the timescale works out so well, because you can say this satellite isn't going to arrive at Alpha Centauri for 100 years. But that means we've just got plenty of time to figure out that last question.
All right, so we identify some moon like light years away, and then we send what, like a rocket? And then what's on the rocket exactly? What happens when it lands? What do they send to us? What do we do with that information? Then what happens on the ground?
Yeah, so you wake up one morning, you're an astronomer, you've identified a planet out there. We can do some sort of initial testing from Earth to figure out what the atmosphere is likely to be like, what the gravity is likely to be like. And so we can start to find some sort of key candidates that might be interesting, but we don't know for sure. Say we keep going with that until we've got maybe 100 candidates that are interesting. At that point, we take these satellites, we put them on, say, a SpaceX rocket or something. We launch them off into space, and they're little payloads. So they don't, you know, the delta V to get them to launch, it's relatively economical to send them up. And basically, we just litter these planets with these little boxes. And some of them won't make it, and that's perfectly fine. Some of them will fail, and some of them will get to planets that are totally uninhabitable. It's going to take hundreds of years potentially before they all land.
My parents were visiting last week, and we went to Muir Woods and saw the redwoods. I got a little redwood seed kit, and it gives you like 10. And they're like, hopefully one will grow. And then if it works, you got a redwood.
Yeah, exactly. So the odds of anyone succeeding are low, but that's okay. I mean, it doesn't have to be 100%. And the whole purpose of this is just to increase the odds of life elsewhere. So you send these boxes out. They have some sensors on them that detect atmospheric measurements, surface measurements. We basically confirm the data that we had from Earth and also probably add some more data to that.
And then once we do that, it's like once we get that other information back, we have a better idea of what sort of biological creatures and systems we would need to print remotely to make that planet habitable.
Yeah, exactly. So you'd send out that message back. Maybe it takes a couple of years for the message to make its way back to Earth.
And then you hope that you haven't accidentally started some kind of like interstellar war between alien species.
it's a risk that you take.
For the good of all life.
Yeah, for the good of all
life. Which they'll probably understand if, you know, we're dealing with some intelligent beings across the universe.
They may well have been through their own experience trying to
do this. We might get a little black box like that ourselves.
Yeah.
What would we do? We would just be like, no thanks, and we just shut it off.
Yeah, well, it was unnecessary to send it to this planet because there's already life here. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of the question. I mean, you could also think statistically, right? The odds of us encountering another alien species, just because of the selection bias, it's much more likely that they'll be a colonizing species too, right? So they're likely to be in favor of the idea of spreading life just by the fact that those are the ones you're going to have more solar systems like that. You could hope that they'll be favorable, you know, and think that that's a...
Right. But, you know, 10,000 steps back, we still do not even know that alien life is possible outside of Earth. And if that's the case, then maybe the burden lies on us somewhat to bring life with us into the galaxy. Why is life important?
I think life is important because it's a fundamentally weird thing to happen. As far as we can tell, it hasn't happened any other place. It may have happened some other place, and we'd hope so, but we might be it, and we certainly might be it for a long way out there in our little corner of the universe.
The fundamental weirdness of life is something we're going to take a closer look at a little later in this episode, because that weirdness may have more utility than you think. But first, let's get back to the story at hand, our interstellar journey, because Earth, I don't think it's where people stop. And I think most people would agree. I think most people kind of know it. We can feel it in us. This sort of like call of the stars. It's why our science fiction looks the way it does. A cosmic seed packet is a great backup plan, and I think that we should be working on that. But the journey through space is our future. It's who we are. It's us on new worlds. And for a journey this extraordinary, an interstellar journey, we need a spacecraft fueled by something with a little more bang than chemical rocketry. Let's take a closer look at antimatter.
The thing with specific impulse is that the optimum specific impulse is related to the distance that you have to go. So antimatter concepts, while they are very valuable inside our own solar system, they get more valuable the farther away you go.
That's Ryan Weed, who you probably remember from this season's third episode, Strange Rockets. Ryan's the CEO and co-founder of Positron Dynamics, and they're working on the anti-electron.
Antimatter has the highest energy density of any material in the universe, and so we're trying to harness that for use in spacecraft.
Antimatter propulsion is for sure a wildcard technology. It's not something we have working yet, but it is something theoretically possible that once we do get it or something close to it working, will change everything. In the context of traveling around our own star, for example, that's cool. It's going to speed things up, you know, for sure. But while antimatter thrust would dramatically pick up our pace within our home orbit into Mars, for example, casual jaunt around our solar neighborhood, not really why this technology's so exciting.
So the outer solar system, like Pluto, rather than taking a decade, it might take a year. And so and if you look at further out, going to places that are light years away, then that's really where a high specific impulse concept like antimatter propulsion gets really valuable.
Can you walk me through the math here? Because I saw part of your video and you talked about traveling between stars, and it seemed just the amount of time seemed to get there seemed shockingly low.
Yes, yeah, to some extent, the closer you get, if you scale your antimatter propulsion system high enough in thrust, you can start reaching significant fractions of the speed of light, and then you open up that can of worms in terms of special relativity and time dilation. But even before then, if you can accelerate to even 0.1 of the speed of light, 10% of the speed of light, you can think about getting to Alpha Centauri in a human lifetime or a few decades. And so, you know, if you compare that to if you were taking a chemical rocket trip to Alpha Centauri, it might take, 20 or 30,000 years, which is pretty infeasible.
The truth is, I never really saw a convincing path forward for humans into the galaxy until I talked to Ryan. It's not inconceivable we get this working. It could happen in our lifetime.
Hello, this is Houston. We're copying.
Got it. So we've got antimatter thrust. We have at least theoretically some kind of protection from the radiation. What about the speed? I mean, we've never seen people moving at these speeds, human beings moving at these speeds before. How fast can we go physically?
There's no limit to how fast we can go. The only limit is how fast we can accelerate. All of these concepts will initially produce a level of acceleration much less than 1G. We can survive quite well at 1G. And so the only issue is that if you run into something going 10% of the speed of light, that's when things get more complicated. So,
I mean, complicated is one way to put it. All right, great. So that's that. That's our 1 month trip to Mars or our 1 year trip to Pluto. Or, I mean, I'm not sure how far away Titan would be. Do you have any idea of how far away Titan would be? I'm always interested in what's going on in the Saturn orbit.
I'm not sure about Titan. It might be a couple of years rather than a month to get there. Yeah, I think outer solar system is interesting. Mars is definitely interesting. Yeah, what I'm interested in is developing technology that allows us to get outside of our solar system. So that's kind of the driving force behind our company.
Great. Let's talk about Alpha Centauri. So you mentioned that with this kind of technology, traveling at a tenth the speed of light gets us to Alpha Centauri within a human lifetime. How many years are we talking? And, what is the infrastructure of a civilization that can travel between stars look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think I have a great answer for how interstellar travel is going to transform our society, but I can tell you that it is in our future. So we should start thinking about whether or not, one, we want to, and then number two, kind of come up with a plan of attack. How do we want to travel to Alpha Centauri? What do we want to do once we get there? It'll take 40 years to get there with this technology. Maybe someday we'll generate some other form of travel to get there even faster. I don't know. One thing is true in that we can't get around the laws of special relativity. And so that's going to be, I think, a great challenge for any interstellar traveling species is that you can't travel faster than the speed of light. And also traveling next to the speed of light or close to it will have very significant repercussions in terms of time.
All right, so relativity, big scary word, but in the context of interstellar travel, I think it's something the movie Interstellar pretty much nailed.
Look, I could swing around that neutron star to decelerate.
No, it's not that. It's time. The gravity on that planet will slow our clock compared to Earth's drastically.
Oh, how bad?
Well, every hour we spend on that planet will be 7 years back on Earth. That's relativity, folks.
All right, so back to reality. Well, kind of.
Right. So a 40-year trip to Alpha Centauri, or a trip that feels to the passengers or the robots that are going like 40 years, feels to us back on Earth like how long?
That's only going 10% of the speed of light. So time dilation will be only a fraction of a percent. Once you get up towards 0.6, 0.8, and 0.9, 99% of the speed of light, then you start getting into time dilation factors in the thousands, which means that anyone you've ever known back on Earth is going to be long gone. So everything you want to see again, you better take with you.
Can you place this in terms of Earth years for us?
If you look at, for example, a spacecraft that could travel constant acceleration at 1G. So that's kind of where we like to live. Say we design or we scale an antimatter-based propulsion system to produce 1G acceleration, you can reach sort of the edge of our galaxy and only about 40 years has passed for you, whereas 100,000 years is gone in the Earth's reference frame. So, I mean, those are the kind of scales we're talking about when you are going very close to the speed of light.
And what about our closest stars, Alpha Centauri, a trip to Alpha Centauri? What does that look like for the folks waiting for our astronauts to come home?
Yeah, I mean, sure. Alpha Centauri, our closest star, roughly 4 light years away. It's kind of the beginner's luck that we've got a star that close. And there's evidence of a planet in the habitable zone out there next to Proxima Centauri. So, I mean, it's a very interesting place to go to, I think. Because it's so close in light years, I mean, we don't have to deal with that consequences of special relativity yet. We could go there, come back, and really have only, you know, time dilation factors of a few percent. I don't think that's going to be a game changer in terms of special relativity, but that really only comes into play when you're talking about, you know, hundreds and thousands of light years away or on the other side of our galaxy.
So to be clear, that means a trip of 4 light years in distance, taking at a tenth the speed of light, that takes, you said, about 40 years. That would feel to folks on Earth, you know, roughly
the same, give or take a few percent.
And then 40 years back, so we're saying within one human lifetime, we could send an astronaut to and then back from Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, that's feasible. I mean, 80 years is a long time for a single one human lifetime, but yeah, that is feasible, I think.
Feasible. But as Ryan was kind of alluding to here, even with antimatter working, this is not a short journey. And no one wants to spend their whole life stuck on a spaceship. Even if we sent a fleet of robots first and made sure there was a habitable planet or a planet we could make habitable on the other end of our journey, this probably wouldn't be a round trip. I think our astronauts are gonna want to settle our next star system pretty much straight away. And still, 40 years? One way? Even in a world of perfect virtual reality, that's a long time to spend stuck in a giant tin can hurtling through the galaxy. So what if we put our astronauts on ice? Cryonics. What if it was possible to just go to sleep on Earth and wake up in Alpha Centauri's habitable zone?
My name's John Bradford. I'm the Chief Operating Officer and President for SpaceWorks Enterprises. SpaceWorks is an Atlanta-based aerospace engineering firm. We have been conducting research and developing technology to support putting humans in stasis to enable long-duration spaceflight.
So I recently realized that on account of our nation's just, you know, horrific public education system, many of today's youth, and I'm talking like Gen Z here, have tragically never even heard of the greatest movie of all time, which is, of course, Demolition Man, starring Sylvester Stallone and, in her blockbuster debut, the absolutely incandescent Sandra Bullock.
Detective, I am Lieutenant Lenina Huxley. The year is 2032. Now, the reason that you have been released is...
How long have I been under?
36 years.
In the early 90s, this movie introduced the broader American public to the concept of cryonics. The plot is basically, in the future, if you commit a crime, you don't go to jail. You're frozen solid and shelved for a decade or two or five. Stallone's a cop, framed for a crime, put on ice, and wakes up in a dystopian Los Angeles where everything is actually extremely clean and technologically progressive. But it's illegal to curse or have sex, and by the way, hamburgers are canceled.
You, give me a Marlboro.
Yes, of course, right away. What's a Marlboro?
It's a cigarette, any cigarette.
Smoking is not good for you, and has been deemed that anything not good for you is bad, hence illegal. Alcohol, caffeine, contact sports, meat.
Are you shitting me?
John Spartan, you are fined one credit for a violation of the verbal morality statute.
The hell is that?
Also, there's something about seashells replacing toilet paper that I still, to this day, do not fully understand. But what I've been wondering, is this kind of thing realistic? The ice part, I mean. Is it even theoretically possible?
I have very limited experience with cryonics. When I was a small kid, I watched Demolition Man, and then I created a science experiment where I froze ants in my freezer and tried to bring them back to life, and I won first prize. But I don't think it's very scientifically sound. What is the cryonics fiction and what is the cryonics fact?
You see, well, there's a wide spectrum on the scale of, you know, kind of a generic cryonics. So we tend to not maybe use that term with our research just because it does come with a lot of preconceived notions and perceptions, as you noted, from science fiction. It's, you know, movie after movie where you see people are frozen in ice or suspended for long durations, you know, in the context of space flight or extending the natural human lifetime. But what we're working right now, I feel like, is practical or reasonable first step towards actually getting to maybe some of these capabilities that you see in science fiction is metabolic suppression, and that is achieved through cooling down the body. Cryonics is at one extreme of that cooling process, and we're kind of starting at maybe not the opposite, but you know, where a normal person is at about 37 degrees Celsius core temperature, and we're starting the cooling process from there into a mild hypothermic state. With that, you get noticeable reductions in the metabolism. So 50 to 70%, you know, everything slows down and cools down. And that puts you in what would look like a comatose-like state. And we think we can apply that and basically hold you in that state. It's very advantageous when we're designing missions to go to Mars or out into the solar system, because we can basically put people in a very small habitat in a small space and transport them.
That you're decreasing their metabolism by 50 to 70%. Does that mean, I mean, does this affect their lifespan as well? So if they, you know, travel to Mars for 6 months, does that only shave off, you know, X amount of months of their life, or is there no correlation there?
So the correlation, maybe it's anecdotal at the moment. We look to animal hibernators for a lot of our models or comparisons and trying to understand how they hibernate and what processes are going on. Animals that hibernate do tend to live longer than their non-hibernating cousins or species. So we think there is some recovery factor on the body. It's probably not one-to-one, unless we're basically able to stop all cellular activity. Since we're just slowing it down, we think there's some benefits from that, but you wouldn't necessarily get to live 6 months longer if you were in this state for 6 months.
So not a perfect fix, but we are headed in the right direction. Remember, we're not even on Mars yet. Perfect stasis is a long-term goal, and it does at least look like there's something here. John and I got into a few of the specifics of the technology that his team's been working on.
Our kind of stepping off point is called therapeutic hypothermia or targeted temperature management, and that's currently being used in hospitals, research centers kind of all over the world, and it's used as a treatment for traumatic brain injuries or cardiac arrest. In those kind of severe cases, they will take a person, they will cool their body down, generally about 5 or 6 degrees Celsius, you know, 10 degrees or so Fahrenheit, and hold you in that state for a couple of days. And that basically gives the body time to recover. It reduces brain swelling. So that's what kind of what the state of the art is. We can cool people down, put them in this state for a couple of days. And now my company is advocating extending those periods to periods of weeks, if not months. If we can get to a couple of weeks, we can still show a lot of benefits in the context of spaceflight. We could rotate through crew members. They'd be up for a couple of days, then go back and do it again. It's the continuous, you know, extended duration that is more challenging than repeat cycles. If it's at 2 or 3 days, if that's our limit, then probably not a lot of benefit. But we have some very limited test data where it has been applied for 2 weeks. And with no additional complications encountered.
Now, there are a handful of roadblocks before we get this stuff working. For example, feeding and hydrating the body, navigating heart failure, which with our current biology becomes a big issue at around 28 degrees Celsius. This is a problem because the more we can cool our body, the lower we can get our metabolism. And of course, for the journey, we want to lower that metabolism as far as we can. All right, but these are actually problems an entire subset of mammals from multiple evolutionary lineages have a solution for. As a little kid, this was definitely one of the things that animals could do that blew your mind. Hibernation.
My name is Katie Graybeck, and I have a PhD in genetics. My background is in hibernation biology, and I'm CSO and co-founder of a company called Fauna Bio Incorporated. We're working on translating hibernation into therapeutics for human health.
If grizzly bears can hunker down for months at a time, is it really that big of a leap to think humans might be able to do it as well, especially in the context of genetic engineering? So how does all this work? What does hibernation do to the human body, and outside of the space context, why are scientists getting so excited about it? So first, Katie told me about her kind of light bulb moment.
When I was starting grad school, right, you rotate in labs. I went to interview with my future thesis lab, and my future PhD advisor pulled up an image of what a 13-line ground squirrel's year looks like. And basically, she had monitored the body temperature of a 13-line ground squirrel over the course of a year. And I didn't realize till then that when you hibernate, or when mammals hibernate, they actually can reduce their body temperature to near freezing. So I saw this big drop in temperature to about just above freezing. For about 2 weeks, it would arouse and then go back down, and this would last 6 to 9 months of the year. Normally, these squirrels have a heart rate of 200 to 300 beats per minute. When they were in this state of torpor, their heart rate is 2 to 3 beats per minute. So for humans, that would be less than 1 beat per minute. And their heart still functions at near freezing. How could a mammal do this? Because for most mammals, this would actually be lethal, right? So this would kill you right off. You drop below 30 degrees Celsius and you're going to die. How can these mammals actually survive these extremes? And then the crazy idea was that, well, there are many mammals. It's not just squirrels that hibernate. But if you look across all these different lineages, you find hibernators pretty much in every lineage. And even in primates, there are lemurs that can hibernate. And so the idea is that it's not that there's these unique special genes, but these genes that the hibernators are using are the same genes that we as humans have. And they're just using them differently. So if we understood these genes, we could potentially hibernate ourselves.
So I had no idea this stuff even existed before I sat down with Katie. I only reached out looking to talk about long-duration space travel. But what I learned, which is super cool, if we could actually get ourselves hibernating, the benefits are extremely far-reaching.
I don't really love sleeping. I do it because I kind of have to. Sometimes I need it.
Yeah.
The idea of spending 6 months asleep seems kind of crappy. Why do people need to hibernate?
So one interesting aspect is actually just control of food intake. So these hibernators, they spend their summers eating, and they actually eat quite a bit. Their body weight will actually double over the summer, and it'll just be through fat. So they put on all this fat. And then we see even in the lab, they'll have plenty of food in the fall, and all of a sudden they'll just stop eating. There's no external cue. It's all genetically controlled, and then they're not hungry, and they won't eat for another 6 to 9 months of the year. So just for the weight loss application, hibernation is interesting because this is kind of really extreme not to eat for 6 months and not even to feel hungry for 6 months. And so these animals will then just live off of their fat reserves.
Well, so let me just make sure that I understand what you're saying. Are you saying that potentially there's an application of this that would allow, say, an obese person to not eat for 6 months and just breathe away their fat?
Yeah, there could be potential for, imagine a hibernation type resort where we just put people into hibernation. I mean, I think everyone thinks of this awesome idea, like, oh, I'm overweight, you know, why don't I just go on vacation and not eat and hibernate for 6 months and then I'll wake up thin.
That's wild. What are some other applications of this?
This is one of the most interesting or more interesting applications, I think. They have to drop their body temperature, and then they have to periodically re-arouse. This is actually very stressful on the body, and it mimics what happens when you either have a heart attack or stroke. And they're actually protected from these injuries, so we don't see any noticeable damage in their heart or brain, even if you mimic or give them what would be like a heart attack. And these animals, they'll be in torpor for about 2 weeks, and then they'll arouse periodically about 12 hours, and they'll go back down. And so they do these cycles about 25 times. So it's like they're having almost like 25 heart attacks a year.
But it's a simulated, it's not the same as a heart attack. Or are you saying that because they have this ability, they're immune to heart attacks?
If you give them what happens in a heart attack, coronary occlusion, in the summer, these animals actually have damage to their heart. But then if you do it when they're hibernating in the winter, they're actually protected. So they've gained protection in preparation for hibernation.
I mean, that's cool, but you'd have to be hibernating to be, it sounds like you'd have to be hibernating to be protected from the heart attack, so.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, even if they're aroused and warm and you give them a heart attack, they're still protected. So they actually just have.
In the winter, but not in the summer.
Yeah, so there's actually gene expression changes. So basically all you need to do is find out what those gene expression changes are.
Epigenetics.
Yes. Yeah, so epigenetics then, instead of just being able, you know, you have DNA and there's genes that are hard-coded, but then you also need to turn them on and off at certain points of time, right? And then really the fine-tuning and control of gene expression is done through epigenetics.
And so now in the case of, for example, a bear that has protection from heart attacks, but only part of the year while the animal's hibernating mm-hmm. and coming in and out of arousal or arousing in and out of hibernation, what actually happens? It's like a switch goes on and now.
Yeah, so what we see genetically, and when we measure the gene expression readout, we see this like really profound change in gene expression. So there's just a bunch of genes that are differentially expressed from the summer to the winter. And we actually start seeing this happening in the fall, so almost like they're preconditioning or getting ready for hibernation. We'll start to see gene expression changes.
And to be clear, like during hibernation, these animals they're waking up. Mm-hmm. For part of the time, it's part mm-hmm. of the whole process. And while they're awake in the hibernation process, they're protected somewhat from heart attacks, which means that if we could figure out what exactly those genes are just in that window that turn on and protect the creature from heart attacks, it's not crazy to think that we could create some kind of gene therapy for humans that would protect us from heart disease.
Exactly. That's the goal, is then to figure out what those genes are and that genetic signature, and then just target those genes involved.
And if protection from heart attacks or a trip to the world's weirdest ever version of Fat Camp is somehow not enough to pique your interest.
So the animals don't move for 6 to 9 months when they're hibernating. They're effectively in burrows that are covered by snow. They should have atrophy in their muscle and bone over that period. But then they don't have the luxury when they come out of hibernation to then go to physical therapy like we would, right? They have to, especially squirrels, everything wants to eat them. They actually have to, so they're running around, so they don't have this luxury. So they actually don't have measurable decline in bone and muscle loss like we would if we were bedridden. And this is actually a big problem, right? When you're in a microgravity environment, you lose muscle and bone. And I think,
yes.
So again, hibernation could be an application to preventing bone and muscle loss in space, just because these animals that don't move have turned off whatever it is, that the signals that are causing you to lose bone and muscle when you're inactive. And then there's also evidence that when you're in hibernation, you have enhanced protection against ionizing radiation.
This is really cool. So, I mean, there are all of these problems that we're trying to solve that a whole subset of the mammalian family has solutions to. Yeah. They are protected from these things. And if we could figure out exactly what the epigenetic processes that's happening there and mimic it to some degree in humans, we could have protection from bone loss, protection from muscle atrophy, protection from ionizing radiation.
Yeah, actually our common mammalian ancestor, when there was that mass extinction at the end of the Cretaceous, where all the dinosaurs died because of this asteroid, right? How did our mammal ancestors survive that? And the idea is that they actually was able to hibernate and survive that period of resource scarcity.
This would go back to the idea that we have the genes, we've maybe just lost the way of activating them.
Yes.
So how do we do it? How do humans start hibernating? When I met up with Katie, she was with two of her colleagues, Ashley Zender, CEO, and Linda Goodman.
Hi, I'm Linda Goodman. I am the CTO of Fauna Bio.
Linda's background is in computative biology and comparative mammalian genomics. And at Fauna Bio, she's on a kind of genetic treasure hunt.
Genomics has come a long way over the past 10 years. Back when I started at the Broad Institute in 2011, I think we only had around 29 mammal genomes. This year, we have 250 mammal genomes. And what's really exciting about that is now we can actually start comparing the genomes between different mammals and trying to determine what's different about them. So we can look at hibernators and non-hibernators and understand what's different about the genes of hibernators.
As we've previously discussed this season, you know, people always thought the moment we sequenced the human genome, we'd have all these cures to everything that ever afflicted the human race. It has not quite worked out that way. We've been great at collecting data, but we've had a harder time making sense of it. Then Linda brought up some pretty interesting research. 2014, scientists realized the sections of the genome that are conserved or look the most similar among mammals were also the most likely to be functional, which has at least narrowed Linda's search. First finding and then really understanding the genes responsible for hibernation is definitely no small task, but it also no longer seems impossible. This is a question that does have an answer.
What Fauna Bio is doing is looking at different evolutionary genomic signatures. So we're comparing the genomes of hibernators and non-hibernators by looking at what are the genes that are conserved just within hibernators and what are the genes that are very accelerated, so experiencing rapid evolution just in the hibernators. And then when we figure that out, we know those genes really have to be involved in hibernation.
And then once you know, I mean, let's assume that you figure it out. You know what the genes are, or you have a pretty good idea of what the genes are. How do you do anything with that information in the human? Is it therapy, or, I mean, what does that look like?
You get
a shot once in a while. I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, so we're actively trying to figure out exactly what are the genes that are involved. And I think we're well on our way to doing that. We have a lot of really good candidates for these are the genes that turn on and off as a squirrel or a bear enters into hibernation. And what we're working on now is toward a therapy. So we can give you this drug and it'll mean that you can turn on and off those same genes.
It sort of reminds me of a piano. I always thought that we just had different instruments completely, but what if we had the same instrument, we were just playing a different set of music?
Exactly. That's a very good analogy.
We are still a far cry from Sylvester Stallone in a giant ice cube, Perfect Stasis.
but with a working hibernation technology, we'd be well on our way. And this is still only taking into consideration the mammalian genes that already exist. Gene discovery, something we've talked about before in the context of engineering plants, as well as engineering ourselves and self-speciation, opens a whole new door. How long might we be able to hibernate? We are just getting started with this stuff. But for argument's sake, I'm going to go ahead and say we do crack it. And now we're traversing the stars in single human lifetimes. So this brings us, really, to the ultimate question. Not how, but why.
Hey, my name is Richard Muller. I'm a physicist, emphasis on experimental physics, but I do theory when nobody else will. I am a retired professor of physics. I created a course at Berkeley, which got me some degree of fame, called Physics for Future Presidents. Wrote a book with the same title and a sequel called Energy for Future Presidents. Humorous excerpts from that book became a third book, which is The Instant Physicist, little anecdotes that are a joy to win and a way of winning bar bets.
Professor Muller also runs a nuclear business, a fracking business, and Berkeley Earth, a nonprofit focused on global warming and air pollution. From the start of this season, I knew this was where I wanted to end. In fact, my interview with Professor Muller was actually one of the very first I ran. It's almost a year old now. It's exciting that I finally get to share it, because thinking beyond our first new world, one cannot help but wonder where this all leads. What does a universe of world makers look like? And what kind of problems could a civilization that technologically advanced possibly have to worry about? Well, there happens to be something that's disturbed me for a really long time, pretty much as long as I've been able to abstract it. And that's the dragon we're slaying today. But for now, I'd love to talk about the end of the universe,
yes.
Which is why I came to you, is why Sean was kind enough to make the introduction, and thank you for having me. I've been looking ahead, really far ahead. This entire podcast is about Mars, but it's not just a technical challenge. It's also this metaphor for, I think, humanity. Building a new world reflects on everything that we do. I mean, every piece of technology that we build is going to go into this. And what happens when it's done? Like when we finish that, when that whole project is over, I mean, what comes next? Like it's, yeah, you want to go to new world and you want to colonize new planets and you want to explore.
Eventually colonize the entire universe.
The whole universe. But what about the end of the universe? This is something that I thought about a lot. I mean, stars die, but so a lot of different theories on this, how it could happen, or I don't know if they would even be theories or they hypotheses.
There's been some good work done on the subject,
so
some serious work.
To talk about first, what are the more popular ideas concerning the end of the universe? I know of the heat death and the big crunch, but I'm not a physicist, so I would love some help here.
Right now, according to current theory, the big crunch will not happen. With the discovery by a team I put together of the dark energy, we do not expect that to happen. Now, it could be, of course, that in the future, we'll discover, maybe 50 billion years from now, that there's yet another term in the cosmology that doesn't click in until the universe is 50 billion years old. And at that point, there's a new source of attraction that will bring things to a big crunch. So we can't rule it out. Mm-hmm. But the current theory, when I was teaching my classes, I kept on saying, so in the next 5 years, I expect to be able to tell you whether the universe will go on forever or will come together into a big crunch. And then a year later, I said, in about 4 years, and then I said about 3 years. And finally, I had the pleasure of announcing in my class, before it was well known, before it was publicized, I was able to announce that we now know the universe will go on forever. This was because of the discovery by Saul Perlmutter and the rest of the team, the dark energy. The energy that causes the expansion of the universe to accelerate. And therefore, the self-gravity will not turn it around, as I had thought when I started the project. Originally, when I started the project, the goal was to measure how old the universe would be when it came into the big crunch. I turned the project over after about 12 years to Saul. He continued the project, solved most of the problems, and discovered one of the most amazing discoveries of the 20th century, that the universe is not going to turn around. It will expand forever. So that was the discovery of the dark energy. So I think for now, we can get rid of the big crunch worry.
Worry is an interesting word, because for me, the big crunch brought some bit of comfort for some reason. It seemed like if there was a big crunch, the universe would potentially last forever. And of course, I would die, but there was something almost spiritual about the idea of a universe that births itself and dies and births itself again.
I know, but most of the theories said it would not birth itself again.
Oh, so the Big Crunch would end.
It would be it. I'll be a little bit speculative here and depart from established physics, but my own personal guess, when designing experiments, you have to make guesses of the way the physics will turn out. Doesn't mean they're right, but if you have a good intuition for that, you'll make more correct guesses and you'll do good experiments. So my personal hunch is that at the Big Bang, it wasn't matter that was created so much as space. Space was created in the Big Bang. Before the Big Bang, there was no space. There's an interesting calculation you can do that shows the matter in space has its rest energy, mc squared, but it also has a negative binding energy to the universe. And the remarkable thing is, if you do a quick, simple calculation, is that negative binding energy turns out to be minus mc squared. The result is there is no energy in the universe, no net energy in the universe, which explains how it could have been created in the first place. It didn't take the invention of energy. There is no net energy. It's local energy, but that's subtracted by the gravitational binding energy. But if space were created, and space didn't exist prior to the Big Bang. Space, in my mind, is a material. It's like a big rubber, stretched rubber. And when it vibrates, that's what we call matter. But space was created in the Big Bang. And the speculation, and this is just speculation, is that time was also created at the Big Bang. So time exists only starting with the Big Bang. There was no before. Just as you can't ask the question, what is closer together than zero? There is nothing. What happened before the Big Bang? There is no before. And in this picture, the Big Crunch would also be the end of time. After a finite existence, time would not exist anymore. That's simply treating space and time on the same equal footing that we use in relativity theory.
It's a hard thing to wrap your head around.
Yeah, but all these things are hard. I don't care if the universe goes on forever, some people can't wrap their head around that.
Now let's talk about that. So, I mean, I'll kind of fall back to the beginning. So, you have the cosmic egg. You have the Big Bang, where your belief is that space was created and time was created. The universe comes to life, in a sense, begins to spread out. We're about 14 billion years old into this process. What happens next?
What we expect, based on what we know, based on lots of measurements, and based on the theory that fits best with those measurements, is that everything in the universe seems to be uniformly filled up with matter. Everywhere you go, there's no empty space. It's not a block of matter expanding into empty space. All of space is filled with matter. That is, every cosmologist I know will tell you that. But space is increasing. And time is increasing too, obviously. We get a new second every second. So space and time are increasing. And the pieces, which we think now of as galaxies, are getting further apart from each other. There's just not enough interaction between them. The only interaction is gravity. And some galaxies are coming close to each other and orbiting each other. But for the most part, on the large scale, galaxies are just getting further and further apart and will do so forever and at an ever-increasing rate. That's the meaning of the discovery of dark energy.
So practically, what does that mean for existence?
Well, it means it's going to be harder and harder to reach other galaxies. The galaxies themselves are not changing in size, except through their own processes. When you have the expansion of the universe, the galaxies were not getting bigger or smaller. They're all held together by their own gravity, and that's not, as more space is created, they just keep filling up the same amount of space. And so the space all goes in between the galaxies.
The matter within the galaxies doesn't also spread out.
No, it does not.
So we'll have these self-contained.
Yeah, it'll be harder and harder to reach other galaxies as time goes on. Of course, as time goes on, we're talking about a lot of time. And harder and harder doesn't mean impossible.
Right.
It just means we will have to use resources that we cannot predict at the current time. But I wouldn't rule it out. We've had civilization now existing for just 15,000 years. And look what we've accomplished. So the hardest thing to predict is not where the universe will be in a million years. It will be what will intelligent life be able to accomplish in a million years. That is really unimaginable.
All right, which doesn't sound terrible, right?
The heat death is something in addition.
So then now what happens?
The second law of thermodynamics says that the entropy of the universe always increases. What that means is, as time goes on, there are more and more particles in the universe. They are spread out more. Some people describe entropy as the degree of confusion. If you think of a star as burning out, and eventually exploding and all the pieces spread out, you're left with a universe that perhaps has nothing of interest in it.
Dust.
Worse than dust, maybe just individual atoms, gases that just become more and more diffuse. So this is the old picture of the heat death, which I think is highly misleading. The reason I think it's highly misleading is that, yes, entropy increases, but entropy increases largely by throwing off infrared radiation to space. If you look at the entropy of you, think about what you were a year before you were born. You were these atoms. You were probably, maybe you were food, but more likely you were carbon dioxide in the air.
Right. Life is sort of the opposite of entropy.
Life is the opposite of entropy. And there's an essay written by Erwin Schrödinger about this very subject back 60 years ago. Life is the opposite, but it turns out everything in our experience is the opposite. You look at civilization, and we are highly more organized than the hunter-gatherers were of 15,000 years ago. Go even further. You look at the Earth. The Earth was once this hot, molten, unorganized thing where there wasn't even a core. It was all mixed together, and it has cooled off, has become highly organized. We have layers of coal and layers of gold. We have a highly organized Earth. It has cooled off. Is this an increase in entropy? No, it's a decrease in entropy. The entropy of the Earth has decreased enormously since it was formed. The entropy of your body has decreased enormously since change from being elements. Plants are always reducing entropy. Civilization is the reduction of entropy. Even the entropy of the sun is going down every second. So what is this increase of entropy? Am I violating the second law of thermodynamics? No. Because when the entropy of the sun goes down, the entropy of the light it throws off is much higher. So the entropy of the universe is increasing, but almost all that increase is in the form of discarded light that flies out to infinity that we don't care about. Your entropy goes down, the entropy of plants go down because we can emit heat radiation. The heat radiation goes into the atmosphere and then is emitted off into space and goes away. The entropy increase is all in garbage entropy, which is photons that we'll never see again. Everything we experience in life, everything that's worthwhile, comes from our local decrease in entropy. And that's the misunderstanding of the cold death. Yeah, we'll keep on throwing off entropy, but in the process, we become more organized. And the Earth has become more organized. Humans have become more organized. Civilization has become more organized because of the second law of thermodynamics, that entropy is being thrown off to infinity.
So my thought was that in a world of cold or heat death, what is it, by the way? Is it cold death or heat death?
The real irony of this is they call it both.
Yeah.
They call it the heat death because heat means confusion. Cold death because with the expanding universe, the temperature will keep on going down.
So in the event of the cold death, well, I was trying to think of what the biggest challenge humanity could possibly ever face would be. And I thought, well, if the universe has a natural endpoint, then maybe that's the last challenge, is stopping the universe from ending. But it sounds like life itself is at odds with this theoretical entropic end to reality. So in a way, just by virtue of our existing, we're already working towards solving that problem.
This is a fascinating subject. And the most careful and detailed analysis of it was done by Freeman Dyson some decades ago, who rather than just pontificating on this law and that law, and what actually sat down and did a bunch of calculations. What he took into account was the fact that life evolves. And the question he addressed was, as we use up the energy from the sun, what's left? What can we do? But he didn't assume that we would be 5'8" flesh-bound creatures depending on 300 Kelvin temperatures in order to survive. I mean, life evolved from maybe prions, from some very primitive things some 4 billion years ago to rather complex creatures right now. He imagined that that evolution would continue as the universe changed. He was imagining that in the future, life would also expand in scale. I think he was assuming that we're not going to fill up the whole universe with little human beings, but instead we would expand out and be able to live in space at a much lower energy consumption because of our larger size. And what was of most interest to him was the question of whether that would be a life worth living. So he looked at the complexity that could be gained as we lose our small, compact, nerve-type computers and expand it into the world to become much larger organisms. And he did these calculations in some detail. Other people disputed some of his calculations. There were debates about this. But in the end, what he concluded was that for an infinite universe going on forever, he calculated that life would not only continue forever, but that it would continue to become more and more interesting. Interesting in his mind, meaning we would learn more and there would be more complexity and there would be more interactions. And so he had a very optimistic ending to the universe, no end and no heat death, simply a heat evolution that looked like a very attractive one.
It is well within our power to destroy our civilization and perhaps our species as well. But we are also capable of using our compassion and our intelligence, our technology and our wealth to make an abundant and meaningful life for every inhabitant of this planet, to enhance enormously our understanding of the universe and to carry us to the stars.
I don't think the human race has a moral obligation to learn about space, but it would be foolish and short-sighted not to do so. It may hold the key to our survival.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The story of Mars. How we get there, how we reshape that planet, how humanity becomes a multiplanetary, spacefaring civilization. It's a good story, which is not to say, I mean, entertaining, though, like, I do hope you enjoyed it. This story and the actual manifestation of this story in our reality is important morally. If you care about life, if protecting and preserving life is a value of yours, Mars is the only way. This season, we set out to piece that story together with folks we've had the very great fortune of getting to know through our work at Founders Fund. My thinking was, all right, so we're all sort of working on this in our own way, even if we don't know it. I thought Mars is inevitable, so we can just kind of piece together the work and show everyone how it's going to happen. But what I found was, while the technology is pretty straightforward, we could be building our first colony on Mars 5 years out if we really pressed ourselves, motivating people forward is more of an issue. NASA does not have a plan. Elon Musk says he does, and certainly the work we've seen from SpaceX has totally changed the space industry and greatly increased our odds of getting to Mars. But people have to want this. People have to understand why this is important, why we need to do this. Because with no common enemy, no clear existential threat like we saw in the Soviet Union during the Cold War, we have nothing left to motivate us other than this sense that this is our purpose. Other than this belief that this is important, that actually what we do here, our answer to these questions defines us. Do we build a new world on Mars, then Titan, then travel to distant stars and colonize the universe? Do we become a high-energy civilization, a cosmic society? Do we crack the codes of reality and save the universe's life? Do human beings defeat entropy, or do we give up? Human destiny is a binary choice. We can build whole new worlds around new stars, or we can fade away. This is a podcast about never fading away. From Founders Fund, I'm Mike Solana. Thanks for listening. This is Anatomy of Next, New World.